For many years, we've been searching for what is the cause of narcissism. It's been wondered, could it be to adverse childhood experiences, maybe trauma? But research has been finding that narcissism is primarily a biosocial problem. In other words, narcissists are born with personality deficits. Is it fair, then, to hold them accountable for the damage that they cause? In this episode of Breaking Free from Narcissistic Abuse, we're going to explore this topic in depth. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm your host, Dr. Carrie Kerr McAvoy, a mental health specialist with over 20 years of counseling experience and a narcissistic abuse survivor. I'm so excited that you're hanging out with us today. Please leave a review and let us know what you think of the podcast, and be sure to subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. Would you consider donating the cost of a cup of coffee as a show of your support in our mission to help set abuse victims free from toxic relationships? So, let's listen in to this replay of a TikTok Live.
The interview with Dr. Kristen Milstead exceeded my expectations. It was so good. At one point, I actually, when she was talking about love bombing and the relationship that we get into with a narcissist, it was so compelling that I actually, for a moment, forgot that it was my turn to ask the next question. I stared blank-faced at her for a moment and like, duh. And then I remember, oh yeah, it's my turn. So let me talk about some big things that I took away from the conference, some that was really, really good reminders. Not something I did, it wasn't new to me, but it was a good reminder from a psychological standpoint. It's very popular to demonize narcissists, to say that every narcissist that we meet is intentionally being abusive, that they know that they're harming us. They get into these relationships with a very, almost strategically, with a strategic plan. And then they set about to unfold this harmful process on us. It actually is sadder than that. What actually is happening, and I'm not saying there isn't a part of it that's deceptive, manipulative, and intentional. I'm not minimizing or letting people off the hook that I know that, because you should know at some point you should know things are going wrong and then you should be accountable. But let me start out today, before I start taking questions, unpacking what goes wrong in a narcissistic relationship. What's going wrong? So imagine that you're born with something missing. The ability to connect intimately with other people has been defective. So you struggle to know how to show up in a relationship in a vulnerable way and get your needs met. You want it. You're built to need it, just like every other person needs it. You're built to need this connection. But when it comes to knowing how to make it last, something is missing, something is wrong. And they don't understand the fact that what's wrong is they lack empathy. And in order to really have a powerful connection, empathy doesn't just make us sensitive. Empathy makes us present. It allows us to get into sort of the head or the feelings of another person and have a sense of compassion for them and recognize that they're like you and me. It builds a bridge of connection between you and other people. But because empathy is wounded or missing, they can't do this, the most critical piece to build a relationship with somebody else. So they're hungry for it. They're hungry for it in the same way everybody else is hungry for it. And there's another thing missing, and that whatever they do to get their needs met, it doesn't last. Imagine that you're hungry and you're, in fact, not just hungry, you're starving. And somebody puts a huge plate of food in front of you. You gulp it down in desperation and you get done thinking, oh, I'm going to feel better. I'm going to feel, you know, that warm sensation I have when the food hits the bloodstream and hits my brain, and I'm going to start to feel better. I'm going to get rid of that shaky, awful feeling. And it never happens. You're still starving. So you eat again, thinking, oh, this will fix it. I'll feel better. I'll feel satiated. And then it doesn't happen. And you eat again. That's called low receptive capacity. When that happens interpersonally, that's called low receptive capacity. It makes sense because receptive is what you're taking in. Capacity is holding it. And low means you don't take it in. You can't hold it. Okay, so you're born. You have this need to connect. You don't realize that every effort you're making is draining through you fast. You can't feed yourself with the connection. And you see that you're not really building a connection with other people the way other people do. You can see something's missing, but you don't really know what it is. But you're as needy as everybody else, maybe even more so, because you're starving and it never lasts inside you. And you can't walk away from a connection and be like, oh, that feels so good. You don't have that. So what do? Well, you get really good at building a connection with somebody. You learn to watch them. You learn to kind of pretend, to sort of create what you see other people doing in order to make this happen, and hoping that maybe there's this one unique person in the world that's going to do this perfectly, and it will be such a match that it will fix everything that's wrong with you, and you'll have this incredible connection, love, incredible love and connection with this person, and it will be amazing. And so you begin to look for this person. You think every time you meet them, you think it happens as you're honing your skill at making it happen better and better and better. Because that's one thing you're really good at, is you're really good at observation and picking up all these cues. So you get better and better and better at like pretending, masking, going along with it. You get better and better at that, and it goes faster and goes really well. And you get people falling for you when it happens. At first you think, oh, I found them. This is the person. This is going to be it. And then, sure, you know, find out they're just like everybody else and the relationship doesn't work. And soon enough, they do something that like blows your dream apart and you know, this is not the person. And then you start to get disillusioned and you try to figure out how you're going to get rid of this person. And you begin to look for the new person who's going to do this, maybe hopefully even better. That's what narcissists are doing. Now, here's the part that I feel like this is where they're accountable. I once had a client come into my office years and years and years ago. This is way back when I started. So I'm talking like 30 plus years ago. I met this young lady, attractive young lady. She sat across from me. She was super sincere. I didn't realize at the time. I knew the truth, but I didn't realize I probably had met either a love addict or I've met a narcissist, a female narcissist. But she sat across from me and she said, I don't know what's wrong with me. Love just doesn't work. And I said, well, what do you mean? What do you mean love doesn't work? She said, well, you know, I meet somebody and I have this crazy, wonderful experience with them. And then it fades and it goes away. And then I do it again and it doesn't work. You know, it's crazy good in the beginning and then it fades and then we get rid of them. And I looked at her and I said, well, honey, that's never going to work. That's just called infatuation. And we all have that, but that fades. We need to move on to the next part of the relationship, is where you make a commitment to somebody, you get to know them, you build a relationship with them. And she just looked at me and I said, you know, if you keep doing what you're doing, you'll just only do this hundreds to thousands of times. You will never find whatever it is that you're looking for. And she just kind of looked at me. You know what? I never saw her again. She never came back into the office. But that's an example of somebody who is early into it. And here's So they recognize that it's going wrong, but then they don't do anything to fix it. They don't do anything to say, wow, I can't stand doing this. I'm hurting people. It's hurting myself. I'm constantly disappointed. I need to do something better. So I need to go work on myself. Something's really, really off here. That's what doesn't happen. Instead, they continue to persist in the fantasy that there's this perfect connection. And then they go from person to person to person to person, hoping that somehow, somewhere, that the unicorn exists and it doesn't. There's the part that they need to take responsibility for. So now, is that demonizing them? Well, that's the same kind of level of responsibility that everybody has to take for our lives. When we recognize something's going wrong, it's up to us to do something about that. Instead of just harming people, we need to make a change. So that part I feel, you know, they're definitely accountable for. But as far as it goes to the brokenness, I mean, it's not their fault that they're broken and all of that. But it is their responsibility to do something, make it different.
Would you be interested in meeting in person? Maybe you'd like to have a one-on-one appointment that's face-to-face. Well, on October 15th, I, along with 9 other narcissistic abuse content creators and coaches, will be live to meet you in Austin, Texas at the Deva Deva Labs. That includes Lee Hammack of Mental Healness, Lisa Sunny, Stronger Than Before, Catherine Kleiss, Stand Coaching, Trey De La Torre of I Was Like Yo, Trey, Nia Renee, How to Love a Battered Woman, along with many others, just to name a few. We'll be hosting a 90-minute VIP forum where you'll be taking your questions, along with the one-on-ones and a public meet-and-greet from 3 to 6 p.m. If you'd like to go, please register for the event through the link in the show notes below. I can't wait to see you.
Have I ever seen a narcissistic person change their ways? Yeah, I actually have. I worked with one. He and I worked together probably 7 to 10 years. And I was like one of his, he'd had many, many therapists. And I think he had like 20 plus years of therapy, 20 plus years. So I was near the end. You know, I don't know if he's continued with somebody new. He may have. He may always be in therapy, honestly. He was definitely a narcissist, and he was recognizing it at the end. No one had used those words with him earlier in his treatment, but by the time he was seeing me, he was starting to identify that he was having problems with shame, that he had excessive need to be seen as special and really wanted people to give him privileges for that. He kind of saw his entitlement. So he was openly talking about and identifying his problems. Yes, he was struggling with empathy. He wasn't always good with seeing it when it was happening, but he was learning how to see it with me, to talk about it with me. Now, I did get to see his marriage. There were hardships on both sides, but I do think that there was once he kind of got out of the heat of the moment and had some reflection, because he was a very intelligent man, I think he would probably circle back and make some corrections. So yeah, I've seen some change. Here's the thing. It's personality disorders is actually a deficit of certain traits. And as a result of the deficits of traits, you have to learn new ways to work around what's lost. So it'd be like losing an eye and learning to navigate drive with depth perception, because you don't have the two eyes to work to give you depth. You'd have to learn new ways to do that. I once knew somebody who was colorblind. They didn't see any color. It wasn't just the green, red color blindness that's common. This person saw no color, and they were trying to pick strawberries. They learned how to pick strawberries, recognizing the degree of gray. So it is possible to learn new ways to work. I mean, our brain's amazingly adaptive. So I'm saying it is possible, but here's the problem. The problem is it takes self-reflection. They also are lacking that ability as well. So how do you learn? How do you even know the problem is you when you can't really see yourself well? So it's very complex. But that's a long answer to say sometimes, once in a while. But the short answer is, I would say anyone who's in a relationship with one and is waiting for that, thinking, oh, they'll be better and they'll be really sensitive and life will be, no, I'm not. I would tell you, you're probably going to waste a lot of time waiting for something that's minimal gains, unfortunately, really minimal gains. It would take a very unique person to do that. Somebody wants to know, why do narcissists stalk? Yes, they do stalk. And I know many of us have experienced that they just don't seem to disappear. They stay present in our life. So let's back up. I started out by saying, imagine you're always hungry for love and then you end up you can't find it. It's just sort of like, it's like starving for food. And every time you eat a huge plate of wonderful food, you still are as starving as you were after you ate, as you were before you ate, that it never worked. But yet you sort of feel connected. Imagine you sort of feel like this connection with the supply is it's like they belong to you because of this entitlement, because you see yourself as special, because you're kind of broken in your ability to see people as whole people. All of this causes you to sort of struggle with recognizing others as individuals of their own lives. And as a result, you become a collector, is what really is happening. That's kind of a crude way to put it. They're collecting relationships, collecting people, because you're not really a person. You're sort of like a set of salt and pepper shakers that sit on somebody's shelf, or you're like a really wonderful car that they now put into the warehouse. They sort of like collect. And then they reminisce because they're always hungry. See, if you have a mentality of, I'm always starving to death and I need more and I need more and I need more, then when you're low on something and you want to sort of refuel again, you'll go back and visit the things that you used before that worked. And that's the breadcrumbing, what we refer to as breadcrumbing. So they sort of go back and they kind of reminisce, they'll send you photos or they'll text you or they'll do something. They'll visit your social media profile. They'll do something to reminisce about the good times that they had with you and try to connect with you again. That's when you're at risk of them coming back and hoovering you in order to sort of refuel themselves. And I think there's another reason too. And I know mine has stalked me as well. And I think there's a part of them that there's the jealousy aspect. They feel life's unfair and they're special, remember? They're special. So that means they should get the best of everything, but it doesn't work out that way. And because it's not working out that way, they watch you. They hope that they made your life better and that when they leave your life, they hope that it sort of falls apart. And so they're also stalking as a way to sort of keep up with you to sort of see, does it fall apart? Because they're hoping that it falls apart because God forbid it does better, because that then means there wasn't them that made your life better. It wasn't that they're not that good. And that, again, kind of ties into their fear of shame and abandonment and all of that. And that's very, very scary for them. So they stalk you as a sort of way to reassure themselves, although it rarely works that way because most of us, once we get away long enough and well enough and we start to do our healing, we start to look better. We start to pull ourselves back together. So that, I think, actually causes more stalking because they're like, how dare this person do better? They shouldn't do better. So they kind of then watch as a way to sort of wait for you to fall apart again, you know, hoping that it's going to happen. Hoovering is a word that we use. It's a pull you back in a relationship after the relationship is over. Think of a vacuum, how that vacuum, like a Hoover vacuum, sucks things up. Well, they'll try to suck you back into the relationship. That's why we use it, is because they'll come back and they'll say, I've changed. I've worked on this. I've had these epiphanies. I realize I've been doing things wrong. Can you come back to me? And it sounds believable. And you think, oh yeah, this is really what I wanted. I wanted this relationship to work. I never wanted us to fall apart. So you get hopeful and then you get back into a relationship with them and then it goes wrong. Because here's the thing. Now, if there was real change and if you had true remorse and guilt and you did your part to work on yourself, then you would take ownership of what happened and you'd be different the next time around. That's what we all think. When someone comes back, we think, oh, they've been working on this and they've seen the light and this is going to be a better this time. But what we don't know is that nothing's changed. What's changed is their sense of emptiness is just back and they just want you back in order to fix the emptiness. They haven't changed. Just their situation has changed, and that's why they want you back. And here's the other really bad part about hoovering, is that they know they didn't do right with you the first time, but they want you to sort of like, they kind of compartmentalize. So to them is the past. But when you take them back, they think, oh, that means that all of that didn't matter. They're okay with it. So then what happens, they end up being worse than they were before. It's like you just signed off on all the abuse you suffered the first time around. So you're going to get the abuse even worse the second time around. So be really, really careful with that. Don't fall for this. So the question always comes in, well, then how do I know if someone really has changed? Because once in a while, somebody actually does change. How do I tell the difference? Well, the big difference between somebody who's just desperate, hungry, and wants a return to something familiar versus somebody who's actually had, you know, an epiphany is that real change doesn't happen. It's not going to happen fast. They'll have taken a long break. You'll have seen them make radical changes elsewhere in their life. They'll have learned, here's a big one, they'll have learned to live alone and be with themselves. They'll have been stepping it up with the kids and doing a better job. And they will be very remorseful, heartbroken, truly like heartbroken over what has happened, the damage done in your life and what has happened in the past. So if you don't see that kind of radical honesty and accountability and responsibility, this person has not done the hard work. They are looking for another shortcut to just feel better because they are hungry people, emotionally hungry people, and they're back into the relationship again. Can an insecure person be confused with a covert narcissist? It's a complicated question because let me first kind of jump forward about narcissism in general. Narcissism isn't like an either or. It's not like you are or you aren't. We're all on the continuum because it's not only is it a neurological deficit or a personality deficit, because none of us are born perfect, by the way. Your personality has weaknesses in it, inherent weaknesses, and it has strengths. You may be somebody who is incredibly disciplined. You set your mind to a goal and you hit the goal. But when it comes to being, maybe when it comes to controlling anger, you're not so good at that. You fly off the cuff and then later you turn around and you look at yourself and think, why did I do that? I feel really stupid for that. We all have inherent strengths and weaknesses in our egos. They're called ego strengths, ego weaknesses. So narcissism is just is a way to describe a certain type of ego weakness. And we all are narcissistic, by the way. Narcissism actually is how we see ourselves as a person and have confidence in ourselves and know how to put ourselves first or forward. Maybe we know how to share the floor, but we still know how to have our own back. So some people say that there's healthy narcissism and then calls the dysfunctional kind pathological narcissism. Others, clinicians will say, no, we're using the word narcissism wrong altogether. But just be aware of that out there you'll hear some people refer to healthy narcissism, which is actually just good self-esteem. And then you'll hear them talk about pathological or dysfunctional narcissism as pathological. But then the others will say, no, narcissism, we're always talking about pathological narcissism. We're not on the same page. Just be aware that we're not on the same page. But all of us have vulnerabilities around our ego. All of us do. All of us want people to think we're special. We want people to care about us. We love privileges. So in that way, we're all like narcissists that we want that. But they, you think of it as a continuum. So that on the healthy end, you're healthy and you handle most of these losses to your ego or lack of specialness or other people having it better than you. You handle it pretty well. And then on the other end, you don't. You're not handling those things well at all. So that's how to view it is this big continuum. So insecurity, to me, when I hear the word insecurity, I think of somebody who has some ego weaknesses that maybe are similar to a narcissist. So I think what would differentiate between a covert narcissist, which is actually a vulnerable narcissist, that's the new word for it, vulnerable narcissist, is that a vulnerable narcissist can never share the floor with anybody else. It's always about them. Whereas an insecure person, hopefully, after they have their moment of insecurity or shake up or whatever it is that, you know, kind of rattles them, that they can then show up for you. That to me would be the big difference, the ability to see you and your needs and care about what's going on you and at least share that concern, share the mental space with you. A narcissist will not share the mental space with you. They would have a big emotional kind of moment about something that went wrong and say that you did too. But when it goes wrong for you, they'll say, get over it. You're making a big deal about nothing. Or there you go again. Everything's always a big drama with you. They'll treat you in the exact opposite way that they would never want you to treat them. And so they hold very, very different standards. Hopefully an insecure person wouldn't do that. Well, I would love to know what you thought of today's podcast. Feel free to drop me a note and let me know what you think. Did you happen to miss the live webinar with Dr. Milstead? No worries. You can buy a lifetime access to the replay. Come and learn why we find it so difficult to leave some relationships and hear her describe the 5 stages of love bombing and how a trauma bond is formed. To get your copy, see the link in today's show notes. And until Thursday, I'll see you then. Bye-bye.